from Hospice UK and Dying Matters, this is the Dying Matters podcast. I'm your host, Eleanor McConnell. I have a bit of a confession this week. Before I worked at Hospice UK, I didn't really have any clue what a hospice was. I'd never set foot in one. No one in my family had ever needed end-of-life or palliative care. When I got here, I learned a lot of things that surprised me. Like the fact that hospices don't just care for people with cancer, but for people with all sorts of life-limiting illnesses, such as lung failure or heart disease. Or that a lot of hospice care actually takes place in the home, rather than inside the hospice. The care provided is incredibly personal and bespoke. As well as taking care of people's physical needs, they also look after their emotional, spiritual and social needs, not just immediately before death, but from the point of diagnosis. They also support carers, family members and close friends, both during a person's illness and during bereavement. If you've ever come into contact with your local hospice for any reason, chances are you know just how important they are in the community. Their focus is entirely on improving quality of life and well-being, so that the patient can enjoy whatever time they have left to the full. More than anything, hospice care is about life, recognizing that the need to have an enjoyable and fulfilling life never goes away, even when you're at the end of it. It's very easy to take all that for granted. Hospice care is free, and there are over 220 of them across the country, providing care that is recognized to be amongst the best in the world. This network of hospices, providing expert pain and symptom control, compassionate care, teaching and clinical research, was the vision of one woman, Cicely Saunders. Cicely founded the first modern hospice, St. Christopher's, in 1967. Hospices had existed before this and provided nursing care for the terminally ill, but they were not what we now think of as modern palliative care. St. Christopher's was committed to education and research, as well as excellence in clinical care, and its work totally revolutionised the way that we look after the ill, the dying and the bereaved. Cicely died in 2005, but St. Christopher's continues to further her legacy by providing education and training to anyone from around the world who wants to learn more about palliative care. They also tell her story, which is the story of the modern hospice movement. This week, we're lucky enough to bring you that story from someone who saw it happen. My guest Mary Baines was a contemporary of Cicely Saunders. Cicely persuaded her to leave her job as a GP to join her at St. Christopher's, and Mary ended up working there for 30 years. She's retired now, but she's still often to be found at St. Christopher's, telling visitors Cicely's story. That's where I first met her. Hospice UK always sends new staff members to the St. Christopher's open days, and as someone totally new to the hospice movement, it completely floored me. I think it's a powerful story that shows just how vital hospices are and why we can't ever take them for granted. And as an aside, we're so thrilled that we have Mary's own account of the hospice story recorded. This podcast is a little piece of history in action, and we hope you enjoy it.
So, when you tell the story, how do you normally start?
I quite often start with a question to people, mm-hmm. because it sort of wakes them up, and actually it's very relevant to this. And I say to them, I don't always start this way, but sometimes I do. What do you think doctors and nurses did 150 or so years ago, the late 1800s? What did they do? And in particular, what did they not do? Because they couldn't do it. Now, sometimes I get answers and sometimes I don't, but either way, they usually have to say it yourself. Yeah. And I say to them that the extraordinary thing about medicine then, we know there were doctors and nurses because we read about them in literature, we see them in paintings, but what did they do? And there was actually nothing at all that they could cure, which is very interesting. Most illnesses get better on their own, as actually they still do. Mm-hmm. But if I'm a doctor looking after somebody, I'll get thanked for that, but in fact, it would have got better on its own.
Right.
So what did they do? Well, they did two things. One, they visited people much more than they do now and supported and cared for them and their families during the course of an illness. And two, that there were certain drugs that they could use to relieve symptoms. For example, morphine, which is an extract from the poppy, as you know, I'm sure, has been available for thousands of years. It was found in the papyrus Ebers somewhere in Egypt, and other simple drugs like that. So they could do two things. They could control certain symptoms, and they could support people in their illness. Actually, that's not a bad description of what palliative care does today.
Yeah.
And time and again, I get people who come today to the Friday visit, or on other occasions, and say to me, well, palliative care is a very new idea in my country. And I just laugh at them and say, no, it isn't. Of course, it's a rediscovery and improvement of all that medicine was, if you go back over 100 years. But then what happened to medicine? Well, of course, anaesthesia was invented in the late 1800s. And suddenly, doctors could operate and remove an offending organ, say the appendix. And that patient would be cured. And it must have been so exciting to be the first doctor who could actually cure somebody as good as if they'd never had it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the antibiotics came in and so much more. But the side effect of all this was that undoubtedly it made doctors feel, and probably nurses, but mostly doctors, that their job was to cure. And they put on one side the caring and symptom control that their fathers and grandfathers had practiced.
Yeah.
And people in England, at any rate, realised in about the 1950s that not all was well with the way medicine was going. It was failing a great number of people who had incurable illness. And after all, each of us will get an incurable illness at some stage. Me probably before you, for obvious reasons, but you never know these things.
You don't.
You don't.
So doctors would focus on patients that they could
cure. That's right. That is right. That's right.
And what happened to the patients who couldn't be cured?
Well, they were sent home. And there were a few, very few, hospices then. For example, St. Joseph's in Hackney, I think it was opened in 1905, quite at the turn of the century. But that gave patients excellent nursing care and excellent spiritual care, but there was virtually no medical care for the reason that I've given you, that these people were incurable and therefore, in their view, past the care of doctors whose job was to cure.
Yeah. So where does Cicely Saunders
come into this? Well, she comes into it at about that sort of a time, in the mid-20th century. Cicely, as many people know, had an unhappy childhood. Her parents later separated, which was not very common then. She was sent to an expensive girls' boarding school where she wasn't happy. And she went from there to Oxford to read politics, philosophy and economics, the sort of Oxford degree that a lot of our politicians, top politicians, take. The war then came. She was born in 1918, and indeed, this June, we celebrate 100 years from her birth. So the war, the 39-45 war, came while she was at Oxford. And she felt it was wrong to be studying books when there was practical work to do. So she left Oxford, much to the anger, really, both of her parents and the tutors at Oxford, and went to St. Thomas's Hospital in London, where she trained to be a nurse.
Right.
She loved nursing. And felt that this was where she wanted to spend her life, nursing. But she had a bad back, and the lifting involved then in nursing, before the days of hoists being used widely, was making her back worse. And she saw the orthopaedic surgeon at St. Thomas's, and he said to her that on no account must she continue in nursing, or she would do irreparable damage to her back. but she wanted to stay involved in patients. So she decided to retrain as a hospital social worker.
Okay.
That's what she did, partly at Oxford and partly at St. Thomas's. And it was during her training that another very crucial event happened. The family were not churchgoers. Cicely had said at school that she was an atheist. But in her mid-twenties, she began to query these things. And then she went on holiday while she was doing her social work training with a group of Christian friends. And it was there that she decided that she'd been wrong, and she became an active Christian. She prayed a quite remarkable prayer, which in a way is the seed of the hospice movement. Lord, what must I do to say thank you and to serve? Not a bad prayer.
No.
Right, she had to wait 2 years before she had the answer to that. But she completed her social work training. And it was while then working as a social worker that she met this young Polish man, David Tasma. And it was through him that her prayer was answered. It gave her a reason for what she should be doing. David was a Polish Jew.
A refugee.
And everybody knows that, no, not really. Well, he'd escaped, really. Yes, I suppose you'd call it a refugee now. We didn't call it that then. A refugee, if you like. But he'd come, he'd escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto before the uprising there, and had come to London, and he was working in London as a waiter, serving at tables. He was in his 40s, early 40s, and he developed a cancer from when Cicely met him. There was no cure. And she visited him quite a number of times, both on the ward, and then he went home, and then he came back again. And I asked her once how many times she'd visited David. She said, Mary, I'll go and look it up. And she had a meticulous diary, which she kept everything in.
Mm-hmm.
She came back the next day and she said, it was 25 times.
Mm.
Not a huge lot of times to change the world, really, as he has.
Yeah.
Yes. But as the two of them talked, they realised that David's needs, which were many, were not being met in that busy surgical ward.
Mm.
He was in severe pain from his cancer. And you won't know how they treated pain then. They treated it with intermittent injections of opioids.
Right.
Morphine or heroin. But when I say intermittent, the patient had to ask for it.
Mm.
So David would have an injection which would last 4 hours, which is the time that injection lasts. Then, of course, he'd be in pain again. If you were in his situation, you'd say, please, nurse, can I have another injection? And the nurse would say, oh, no, you can't, because you're only written up for it 3 or 4 times a day. At any rate, you might get addicted.
Yes, I'd heard that before, that doctors had this massive concern that dying patients would get addicted to opioids. And they were so worried about that.
So worried.
That they kind of missed the main problem.
They missed the problem, exactly. Yeah.
It seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
Like, but we're seeing it now, you know, particularly in America, but to some extent in this country, when opioids are given for, I don't like the word benign pain, but no pain is benign, is it? But non-malignant pain, arthritic pain, and that sort of pain. And people are becoming, it appears, addicted to it. But whatever reason, it seems that cancer patients in pain don't get addicted to it.
Mm.
And there are occasions, you see, when the pain lessens. For example, after a nerve block or after a shot of radiotherapy. And it's not difficult at all, not to suddenly stop the drug, but to reduce it down and then either go on a lower dose or stop it altogether, if there's no pain.
Yeah.
So So physical pain was badly controlled with intermittent injections of opioids. But he had more than physical pain. He had what Cicely later on termed mental pain, emotional pain, and social pain. Emotional pain, because he was just isolated there. He had no one who would answer his questions. Mustn't it be frightening?
Yeah.
To be in that situation, to feel probably that you are coming to the end of life, and have the people who should answer your questions truthfully say to you, oh no, you're getting on all right, and you don't feel you can trust anybody.
No. And you're just parked in a corner of a ward. Exactly. You can't do anything about it.
No. It was Cicely herself who told David that he was dying, which can't have been easy to do. So, emotional pain. But he also had what Cicely later on called social pain, with the interaction with other people. Well, he had it because there was nobody to interact with. His family had all perished in the Holocaust, so he had no known family. And the only other person who came to his funeral, as well as Cicely herself, was his employer.
Yeah.
And then he had, fourthly, what Cicely talked of as spiritual pain. He'd been brought up an Orthodox Jew. His grandfather was a rabbi. But since he'd come to England, he hadn't practiced his faith, and he really did not know whether he believed in God or not.
Yeah.
So Cicely went on then to talk about and write about total pain, physical, emotional, social, and spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Where did she learn that? At the bedside of that young man.
Yeah.
And Cicely was left with the sadness of David's death, and she'd undoubtedly got very fond of David, and with a calling that came through her friendship with David, but she believed came from God, the answer to that prayer, to do something for the better care of the dying. And she didn't know what to do. And what she did at first, which was quite imaginative, is that she went to work at a small hospice, St Luke's Bayswater then, not open now, where there were dying patients, not to do the heavy nursing, because she couldn't do that, but at weekends to help with things like the drug rounds, which were not heavy, and just to test her vocation, to see whether this was something that she felt she could do. And she, working there confirmed her love of working with those at the end of life. So she discussed this with the surgeon, whose social worker she was, and he made a statement that really I don't like repeating, but it's part of the story, so I have to. It goes like this. Cicely, train in medicine. It's the doctors who desert the dying.
Yeah.
And that was undoubtedly true, and countless patients have told me, the consultant does the ward round, comes to one patient and spends some time with her, comes to another patient and spends some time with him, comes to them, or him who is dying, and with a short, morning, Mr. Jones, walks on. I don't think this is because he doesn't care, but I think in a major way it's because he doesn't know what to do.
Mm.
In that generation, he didn't know how to control pain, and he felt very uncomfortable talking to his patients about the fact that they were going to die, feeling that was his failure.
Yeah, and I guess you rationalise that by thinking, well, my time can be better spent with someone who can be cured.
Exactly, yes. So that happened, but he was right to say. So there she was. She was then in her 30s. She hadn't even done the physics and chemistry at school, which of course we now do at school rather than at medical school. But fortunately, St Thomas's, her old hospital, did a course for what is known as first MB, which is the physics and chemistry, then second MB, which is the anatomy and physiology. And then in 1954, she started the clinical course. And it was that year that I joined her. I did my preclinical training at Cambridge, but at that stage we all had to come to a London hospital. And I remember thinking and wondering what hospital I should come to.
So you were training to be a doctor?
Yes, okay. Training to be a doctor.
And did you...
But we were exactly contemporary with Cicely, I was. Because although she was very much older than me, I was in 21 and she would have been well in her 30s.
Right.
Because she'd obviously done all these other things first, which I hadn't. But we got to know each other very well. We were in the Christian Union and that met regularly, so I knew her. And I knew why she was training in medicine. And I thought it was extremely odd. I'd gone into medicine also, I thought, to cure people.
Yeah.
As most people do. This strange lady, older than the rest of us, with a background in nursing and social work, was training in medicine to look after the dying. And if you'd asked me then whether I thought anything would come of it, I'd undoubtedly said no. But can you think of any other man or woman who single-handedly has founded a branch of medicine that has gone right round the world?
No. I can't.
Don't think there is one. She did. So, just going on from our training, I'll tell you what I did quickly and then what she did. Mm-hmm. I got married after the compulsory year when you had to live in the hospital pretty well. So we qualified, did our exams, had that compulsory year, and then were free to pursue what we wanted. So I got married and became a general practitioner part-time, and we had our three children. So it was very part-time. And I expected that's what I would go on with, and very happy I was with it. Cicely, when she qualified and had done her compulsory year, knew that the first thing she needed to do was to find out more about the better management of pain. And she got a bursary to do research in cancer pain management and opted to do it at St. Joseph's, which I've talked about, which was the hospice where there were quite a lot of cancer patients, excellent nursing and spiritual care, but virtually no medical care.
Mm.
Because, of course, it was then believed that doctors' job was to cure, and these were incurable. So she discussed her ideas with the nuns who ran St. Joseph's, and she said that what she wanted to do was not to give a single injection when the pain was unbearable, at the maximum of 3 or 4 a day, but regular morphine or dimorphine by mouth every 4 hours, anticipating the wearing off of the previous one, so that there was a constant level in the body throughout the 24 hours enough to control pain.
Yeah.
It seems very obvious, but was quite revolutionary then.
And how was it received, that idea?
Right. The nuns were not particularly keen at all about it, but they wanted to be helpful. And this is quite funny. They gave her 4 patients that she could try her methods on. So Cicely started on these 4, giving them regular morphine or dimorphine, heroin, giving them the dose necessary to control their pain, and giving the next dose before the last one has worn off. And as I said, this is quite revolutionary. And everybody thought, outside Cicely and a few others, that these patients would get addicted, but they did not. And they weren't even drowsy. After the first few days, while you were getting the right dose, they might have been a bit drowsy. But once you'd got the right dose, enough for their particular pain, which is nothing like the dose put in a book. It has to be measured or titrated against their pain. They weren't drowsy. They became active and ate more and enjoyed life. And although I really don't know this, I suspect that those four lived longer than was expected before they went on the regular opioid. So she was allowed to use more and more. And finally, the whole of the terminally ill part of St. Joseph's was having her methods. And when she left St. Joseph's to start St. Christopher's, because she wanted to have her own place, she had just about 1,000 patients whose pain had been treated with her methods.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Pretty phenomenal for one woman.
One woman. But she did need her own place where she wasn't just subject to what the chief nurses or all nuns wanted. Mm-hmm. And so she then, of course, had to set about raising money for it. And that was done in ever so many ways, including, and this is one which means a lot to me, she made on the radio this week's Good Cause Appeal, which we used to have at that stage, on behalf of the hospice that she was going to build. And I was at home with the children. My husband was out. And I switched on the radio. And there, to my utter amazement, was my old friend from medical school days.
Had you talked to her much in the interview?
No, not at all.
No.
I'm a bit ashamed about that, but, you know, when you get busy and you move away and you have a family and whatever, you can't keep in touch with all the people you were fond of. But anyway, I had a lot of touch with her. But there we are. So I remember telling my husband how wrong I was. And writing to Cicely, and in closing, I remember this, a cheque for £3. Now, you might not think that's very much, and it isn't very much when you're thinking of building a hospice, but I got someone to look it up recently, and he told me that it's now worth £42.13. So it's slightly better than it was. But I got a lovely letter back from her. I became a friend of St. Christopher's and therefore was invited to the opening of St. Christopher's when it was opened, because the money in a remarkable way came in, and St. Christopher's was opened in 67. So last year we celebrated 50 years.
Yeah.
And it was opened free of debt. It cost £500,000, which of course again would be enormously more in today's world.
Yeah. And what was Cicely's vision for St. Christopher's? What did she sort of picture it as?
Yes, people have often asked her whether she pictured it as the centre of a worldwide movement. She used to say no, but it's difficult to know. For people like me, and I'll tell you how I joined her in a moment, she told us two things, really. Our job was, one, to look after the patients on the ward and then those in home care to the very best of our ability. But the second, and it's difficult saying this because it sounds a bit over the top, but it was undoubtedly to change the world's view of dying. And right from the beginning, people like Cicely, well, only Cicely really, would travel around the world and lecture. People like me, who are confined to being around with the family, would keep the wards as far as we could, and later on home care, the patients well looked after. But as well as that, welcome and train the huge number of visitors we had. Some came just like the Friday visit is now, just for one day. Others came for a week or a month or whatever. And I can remember so well, for example, Cecilia ringing me on a Tuesday morning early, saying to me, Mary, we've got an Indian doctor visiting now, and I'd like him to come on your ward round on a Tuesday. And a little bit of you groans, because it will undoubtedly make the ward round longer. Perhaps we won't get a coffee break. Well, we never had a coffee break. We had it on the ward. But that was Dr. D'Souza, a surgeon from the Tata Memorial Hospital in Mumbai. And he went on to found the first hospice project, palliative care project in India, the Shantia Vedna Sadam, an inpatient unit in India. But think what sprung from that one visit.
Yeah.
And I could repeat that time and time again.
Yeah. So when you joined her at St. Christopher's, what was it like suddenly kind of switching over from the medicine you'd practiced before to looking after the dying?
Going back slightly, I had a letter which I still got and show to people sometimes now from Sicily, written before the place was opened. It's quite a funny letter from my point of view, because it says to me, as I'm a local GP, would I like to come and visit St. Christopher's, not just at the formal opening at another time, because I'd be sending patients there and would like to see how it was. That letter, I'm afraid, was, shall we say, a white lie. That wasn't why she wanted to get me there. She wanted to invite me to join her on the staff. And I wrote back to her and thanked her very much and said that, no, I didn't want to leave general practice. My medical friend said that would be professional suicide. And, of course, it was a completely new branch of medicine.
Yeah.
There were no books, no conferences, nobody who really knew what we should be doing except for Cicely herself. And an A4 piece of paper written on both sides that she gave me when I started, called Drugs Commonly Used at St. Christopher's Hospice. She said to me, Mary, this is symptom control. Put that into practice and you'll be all right.
On an emotional level, maybe, was it very different for you?
Perhaps? Yes, it was very different from general practice. Of course, it was.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I missed having people you could cure. But you know, although one can't cure, to actually totally relieve pain in somebody whose life has been marred by severe pain over weeks or months is a marvellous thing to do. I'll never forget the ward round sometimes where I would ask a patient I'd admitted a week before, in agony really, how his pain was. And he'd almost look surprised, because he'd begun to forget about it.
Mm.
And that is thrilling. And also, of course, on the other level, to see somebody who'd not been told what was the matter with him, and his family knew, and they were all at odds, and finding it so difficult to talk frankly, because they knew different things, and therefore couldn't really support each other when they needed each other's support more than ever.
Yeah.
And from time to time, not often, I've actually told, for example, a husband with his wife there, what's the matter with him, so that she isn't put in a position of being asked when she knew. She can, if she wants, pretend to be a bit surprised or whatever. But the important thing is that they know the same thing.
And is there anything that you'd like to see happen for the hospice movement, either in terms of policy or culture?
Yes. I mean, I never forget somebody saying to me, and I had no answer to this, my mother has just received the most marvellous care. She had cancer under St. Christopher's Hospice. And she died well without pain. But But sadly, my father, who died last year, had severe cardiac failure and heart disease, and he couldn't have this sort of care. And that's, in a way, what we set it up when we did. And we had a rather narrow focus. We looked after people with cancer, and we looked after people with motor neuron disease, which is a really, can be a dreadfully difficult illness to manage at the end, in fact, all through. But we did not do others. And really, I think that was right at the beginning, to do supremely well a fairly small spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when the time is appropriate and perhaps resources are better, to be able to enlarge it out.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what's happening now, as we know. That they take people with cardiac failure, with renal failure, with strokes, you know, with all the whole gamut of things. I think there's a concern about that, in that the doctors in particular can't be cardiologists or respiratory physicians. And you don't want to miss somebody having a benefit of some treatment that a cardiologist would know. And it's easy to say, well, hospice doctors should do this and that and the other. But if we don't know it, you'd have to learn other skills.
Yeah.
Or keep in touch with the sending physician. So I suppose that's one's vision. That
hospice care for...
for everybody.
For anyone who needs it.
That's not, yes. And then I suppose there's no doubt at all that my real vision is for the spread of hospice care right around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the privilege of seeing that in so many places, often stemming from a visit to St. Christopher's. I've often said that we at St. Christopher's can teach people what palliative care is, what we must never, ever teach them, is how to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm still excited by it. And I often feel that working in this field, it's like treading a tightrope. You don't want to be too involved, as if each patient was like a relative of yours. And you don't want to be so hard that you're not sensitive to people's needs.
Mm.
And I think it's a sort of tightrope that you walk along and wobble a bit from time to time and occasionally put a foot down. This hasn't happened to me very often, but it has happened. I've been working on the wards at St. Christopher's and I've thought to myself, Mary, I haven't got much to give this afternoon. What I'll do is to do my work as a doctor. I'll admit this patient, I'll be kind to them, I'll prescribe the right drugs that they need, but I really don't feel I can go into their deep emotional problems if they emerge. I'll have to do is to be aware of them and to report them to somebody else and to hope that somebody else will pick that up,
yeah.
Or otherwise I might do it tomorrow or the next day. But actually, I can't do it myself today. Just haven't got it.
Yeah. And it's important to recognise in yourself when
and
that is
the
case.
And you can recognise, yes. And there are going to be people who perhaps impinge on you or very like you, say, in age and family and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
No, I don't say I've done that often, but I have from time to time.
It's a tough job, and that must be a really important skill to know how to...
But in fact, it's very interesting that the rate of burnout, which is what's used for over-involvement and not being able to go on, apparently is inversely proportional to the distance between what you want to achieve and what you do achieve. Now, mostly in palliative care, that distance is quite small. You hope to achieve pain control, and nearly always you do. And that is an enormous advantage. And you hope to control most of the other symptoms fairly well. You hope to get communication better, say, between husband and wife, or mother and daughter, or whatever, and mostly you do.
Mm-hmm.
So that on the whole, that gap there is not enormous. But you think of the gap that a surgeon has when he has to decide whether this man with, say, a bleeding ulcer, stomach ulcer, should be treated by surgery or should be treated, if you like, symptomatically and medically. And if he makes the wrong decision and treats medically and the patient has a huge bleed and dies, think how awful that must be.
Yeah.
He's aiming very high and he achieves nothing. And that, I think, really is stressful, far more than our work. Because you mostly achieve what you want to do.
Yeah. And that's something that can get you through the tougher times.
Exactly.
I feel like that analogy of the tightrope is dead on. People who work for a hospice have to balance all sorts of difficulties and challenges in their everyday work, but I've yet to meet a single hospice worker who doesn't feel uplifted by what they do in some way. And to reinforce just how special that is, we're leaving you with a brilliant song, courtesy of Ben Slack of the Swan Song Project. It's called Hospice Family, and it's sung by Vicky Kent, a nurse at Marie Curie Hospice, Bradford.
Sometimes this job can seem surreal, and at times I just don't know how to feel. It's a challenge and a joy at the same time, an emotional mountain for me to climb. Sometimes I climb up, sometimes down, wearing a smile or sometimes a frown. But when I'm not on my own, with my colleagues behind me, I'm never alone. Yet there's nowhere else I'd rather be than part of the hospice family. We share a hug and a cup of tea. We're part of the hospice family. Some relationships can be so brief. It's a difficult emotion, this thing called grief. An honor and a privilege to be there, someone to lean on in a time of despair. My role requires so many things. No matter what the day ahead may bring, if we can laugh or manage a smile, at the end of the day, it's a job worthwhile. Yet there's nowhere else I'd rather be than part of the hospice family. We share a hug and a cup of tea. We're part of the hospice family. Sometimes we need a friendly face in what can seem such a scary place. I never thought this job would be for me, the good, the bad, and all between. Yet there's nowhere else I'd rather be than part of the hospice family. We share a hug and a cup of tea. We're part of the hospice family. We're part of the hospice family. Part of the hospice family.
I've listened to that song many times now, and it still makes me cry. If this story has moved you in any way, there are loads of ways you can join the hospice family. Next week is Dying Matters Week, and we're asking you, what can you do in your community? One of the best ways to support your community to deal with death and dying is to volunteer at your local hospice. There are a huge range of roles available, so there'll probably be something to match your skills and needs. You can find your local hospice using our Hospice Finder tool at www.hospiceuk.org. Thanks so much to Mary Baines. And thank you also to Ben Slack of the Swan Song Project for letting us play Hospice Family. You can find out more about them at www.swansongproject.org.uk. Special thanks to Bernadette Ryan for our theme music. Dying Matters is a part of Hospice UK, the national charity for hospice and palliative care. If you enjoyed our podcast, make sure you rate and review us on the iTunes store so that we can reach even more people and get everyone talking. Talk to us! Next week is Dying Matters Week, and you can join in loads of conversations online using the hashtag WhatCanYouDo. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Dying Matters.